A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. A listener in Jerusalem is driving an older Seat Ibiza, manual transmission, second hand, and they're not exactly the type to spend weekends under the hood. The question is, what are the maintenance pitfalls that actually matter, and what should they be doing to keep the thing on the road? This is a good one, because the answer isn't learn to be a mechanic. It's knowing which cheap, boring things people skip that end up costing them an engine.
The timing on this is actually important. Used car prices are still elevated globally. We've seen the average age of cars on Israeli roads climb from 6.2 years in 2019 to 8.7 years last year, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics. People are holding onto cars longer. So, the financial case for keeping an older vehicle alive instead of replacing it has never been stronger.
And Jerusalem specifically. You've got hills, you've got heat, you've got dust, you've got stop-and-go traffic that would make a saint curse. It's basically a stress test for every system in a manual car. So let's break down what actually kills an older car, and it's probably not what you think.
I want to frame this around three buckets: fluids, rubber, and metal. These are the things that degrade with time, not just mileage. And that distinction, time versus mileage, is the single most important thing to understand if you own an older car. Most people think in kilometers. They see the odometer, they think, I've only done 8,000 kilometers since the last service, I'm fine. But the calendar is eating your car whether you drive it or not.
Here's the psychological barrier, right? Getting under the hood sounds intimidating. It feels like a domain for people who own socket wrenches and have opinions about torque specifications. But the reality, and I think this is the most useful thing we can say up front, is that about 80% of the checks that determine whether your car lives or dies require no tools beyond your hands and your phone's flashlight. You're not doing engine rebuilds. You're looking at things and touching things.
The single most overlooked maintenance item that kills older cars? I'd say it's brake fluid, and I know that sounds boring, but hear me out. Brake fluid is hygroscopic.
There's the Herman Poppleberry word of the day.
It means it absorbs water from the air, even in a sealed system. The brake fluid reservoir has a vent, because as the fluid level drops when your brake pads wear, air has to enter to equalize pressure. That air carries moisture. Over time, your brake fluid becomes a mixture of glycol and water. In Jerusalem's climate, you're absorbing about 0.5% to 1% water per year. By year 3 or 4, you might have 3% water content. And here's the problem. Brake fluid boils at around 230 degrees Celsius when it's dry. At 3% water, the boiling point drops to about 150 degrees.
Jerusalem in August underhood temperatures can hit 35, 40 degrees Celsius ambient. But the brake calipers near the rotors. You're coming down from Mount Scopus, riding the brakes in traffic, and suddenly, you've got a brake pedal that goes to the floor because the fluid boiled and created vapor in the lines. Fluid doesn't. That's vapor lock, and it means no brakes.
The terrifying thing is it doesn't give you a warning light. There's no sensor for water in your brake fluid. The pedal just goes soft when you need it most. And the fix is absurdly cheap. A brake fluid flush at an independent shop in Jerusalem is maybe 200 shekels. Compare that to what happens if you don't do it and you rear-end someone on Jaffa Road. The math is not complicated.
That's fluids bucket one. And brake fluid is the one people never think about because it's not on the dashboard. Oil changes, everyone knows about oil changes. But even there, you've got a misconception worth killing right now. The idea that if the oil looks clean on the dipstick, it's fine. That's wrong. Oil degrades chemically long before it looks dirty. The additive package, detergents, viscosity modifiers, anti-wear compounds, those break down through shear and heat cycling. You can have oil that looks like honey on the dipstick and has the lubricating properties of water because the additives are depleted. Follow the interval, not the color.
On an older Seat Ibiza, we're talking about the 1.4-liter 16-valve engine, which is in a lot of these cars from the 2002 to 2008 generation. That engine wants oil changes every 10,000 kilometers or once a year, whichever comes first. If you're doing short trips in Jerusalem where the engine never fully warms up, you should be closer to every 7,500. Short trips are murder on oil because you get fuel dilution and condensation that never burns off.
Let's stay on fluids for a minute, because there's another one that's even more boring than brake fluid, and that's coolant. Most people think coolant is just antifreeze. It stops the engine from freezing in winter. So in Israel, where it basically never freezes except maybe in the Golan, people think, whatever, it's fine. But coolant does two other things that are critical. One, it raises the boiling point of the cooling system so you don't overheat in summer. Two, it contains corrosion inhibitors that stop the inside of your engine from turning into a chemistry experiment.
This is one of my favorite failure modes to explain because it's so preventable. Coolant has a pH. When it's fresh, it's slightly alkaline, around 8.5 to 10 on the pH scale. Over time, as the additives deplete, the pH drops. It becomes acidic. And now you've got mildly acidic liquid circulating through your engine block, your cylinder head, your water pump, your heater core. It's eating the head gasket from the inside out. The head gasket is the thin metal and composite seal between the cylinder head and the engine block. It keeps coolant out of the cylinders and oil out of the coolant. When it fails, you get coolant in your oil, or oil in your coolant, or combustion gases in your cooling system. Any of those is a repair that costs thousands.
The case study that comes to mind. This is a real one. A 2008 Seat Ibiza 1.4 in Jerusalem, 90,000 kilometers on the clock. The owner had never changed the coolant. The water pump impeller, that's the little spinning disc that circulates coolant through the engine, had corroded to literally half its original size. The car was overheating intermittently, but only in traffic, so it got misdiagnosed as a thermostat problem. Thermostat replaced. Problem persisted. Finally, someone pulled the water pump and found this sad little nub of an impeller spinning uselessly. A coolant change every 3 years would have prevented the whole thing. Cost of the coolant change, maybe 150 shekels. Cost of the eventual repair, with the water pump, timing belt while they were in there, and labor, about 2,500 shekels.
That brings us neatly to bucket two, rubber. Because on that same engine, the water pump is driven by the timing belt, and the timing belt is the single most catastrophic failure point on these cars.
Let's explain why. The 1.4 and 1.6 engines in the Seat Ibiza of this era are interference engines. That means the valves and the pistons occupy the same physical space at different times. The timing belt is what keeps them from occupying it at the same time. The clearance between a fully open valve and a piston at top dead center is about 1.5 millimeters. That's thinner than a 5-shekel coin.
If that belt snaps at 3,000 RPM, which is just normal cruising speed, the camshaft stops turning, the valves stop moving, but the crankshaft and pistons keep going for a few more revolutions. Valve meets piston within about 0.1 seconds. The result is bent valves, possibly a cracked piston, possibly damage to the cylinder head itself. At that point, you're not replacing a belt. You're replacing the engine or doing a full top-end rebuild. On a car worth maybe 15,000 shekels, that's an economic write-off.
This is a part that costs maybe 150 shekels for the belt itself, maybe 600 to 1,000 shekels for the full job, including labor, tensioner, and water pump. And if you skip it, you lose the entire car. The replacement interval is typically 60,000 miles, about 96,000 kilometers, or 5 years, whichever comes first. And here's the trap. Most owners track mileage, not years. They think, I've only done 40,000 kilometers since the last belt. I'm fine. But the belt is rubber. It dries out. It cracks. It loses flexibility. A 10-year-old timing belt with 40,000 kilometers on it is a grenade with the pin pulled.
The thing is, you can check it without removing anything major. On most of these engines, there's a plastic timing cover, usually held on with a couple of clips or small bolts. Pop that cover off, or at least peek behind it with a flashlight and look at the belt. You're checking for cracks on the rib side, glazing on the smooth side, and any signs of oil contamination. If the belt looks shiny or wet, that's bad. Oil degrades rubber. If you see cracks, even hairline ones, replace it immediately. If you don't know when it was last done, replace it immediately regardless of how it looks. A belt can look fine externally and still fail.
There's a date code on the belt, by the way. Most timing belts have a manufacturing date printed on them. If you pull back the cover and see a date from 2015, you know you're on borrowed time. This is exactly the kind of thing we mean when we say inspection, not repair. You don't need to be a mechanic to look at a date code and do basic arithmetic.
While we're on rubber, let's talk about the serpentine belt. The one you can see when you open the hood, the one that drives the alternator, power steering pump, and air conditioning compressor. There's a dead simple check called the three-finger test. You find the longest span of the belt between two pulleys, and you try to twist it with your thumb and two fingers. If it twists more than 90 degrees, it's too loose. If the rib side has cracks, it's done. A snap serpentine belt means no alternator, so your battery stops charging, no power steering, and on many engines, no water pump. That's an immediate tow. The belt itself costs maybe 60 shekels.
Now let's talk about the stuff that moves, and specifically, what happens when you drive a manual in a city built on hills?
The Jerusalem Special. I love this.
Manual transmissions in hilly cities eat clutches faster. This is just physics. Every hill start is a moment where you're snipping the clutch. The friction material is rubbing against the flywheel, generating heat, wearing down. The steeper the hill, the more you slip, the more heat, the more wear. And Jerusalem's topography is basically designed by someone who hated clutches.
The standard technique most people learn, and I did this too when I first started driving manual, is what I call clutch balancing. You're on a hill, the light turns green, you quickly move your right foot from brake to accelerator while simultaneously finding the bite point with the clutch, and you kind of hold the car there on the clutch for a second while you get moving. Every time you do that, you're removing a tiny amount of friction material. Over thousands of hill starts, you're measurably shortening the life of the clutch.
The correct technique, which driving instructors in hilly countries teach and almost nobody does after they pass their test, is the handbrake hill start. You stop on the hill. You pull the handbrake. Your feet are now free. Right foot on the accelerator, left foot on the clutch. You find the bite point, you feel the car want to move forward against the handbrake, you add a little throttle, and you release the handbrake smoothly. The car moves off without the clutch slipping against the weight of the car on a hill. The handbrake takes the load instead of the clutch. This alone can double the life of a clutch in a city like Jerusalem.
It feels awkward for about 2 days. Then it becomes muscle memory, and the payoff is huge. A clutch replacement on a Seat Ibiza. The dual-mass flywheel alone is a wear item on these cars, and the whole job at an independent shop runs about 2,500 to 3,000 shekels. If you can push that from 100,000 kilometers to 200,000 kilometers just by changing your hill start technique, that's real money.
On the dual mass flywheel specifically, this is one of those things where the early warning signs are subtle and most people ignore them until it's too late. A dual mass flywheel, or DMF, is basically two metal discs with springs between them designed to absorb vibration from the engine. It's a wear item, not a lifetime part. The early symptoms are a judder or shudder when you're pulling away from a stop, especially when the engine is warm. You might also hear a rattling or clattering at idle that goes away when you press the clutch pedal. That's the DMF telling you it's on the way out.
Here's the cost asymmetry. If you catch it early and just replace the clutch plate and release bearing, you're looking at maybe 1,200 to 1,500 shekels at an independent shop. If you ignore the rattling and the juddering until the DMF disintegrates, and they do disintegrate, the springs can break free and take out the gearbox input shaft. Now you're replacing the entire clutch assembly, the flywheel, and possibly the gearbox. That's a 4,000 shekel plus job on a car that's worth maybe 15,000. The difference between catching it early and ignoring it is roughly the cost of a short vacation.
You want to listen to your car, not metaphorically, literally listen. If there's a noise that wasn't there before, especially one that changes when you press the clutch, get it checked. And this is where the find a good mechanic advice comes in, but we'll get to that.
Let's shift to something that's actually simpler than people think, the battery and electrical system. Older cars like the Seat Ibiza have relatively simple electrical systems. No stop start, no hybrid assist, no 47 ECUs. But the battery in Jerusalem's summer heat has a shorter lifespan than you'd expect. In a moderate climate, a car battery might last 5 or 6 years. In Jerusalem, where summer underhood temperatures can exceed 60 degrees Celsius, you're looking at 3 to 4 years. Heat accelerates the chemical reactions inside the battery, including the ones that cause sulfation, the buildup of lead sulfate crystals on the plates that reduces capacity.
The check is dead simple with a $10 multimeter. Set it to DC voltage, touch the probes to the battery terminals. With the engine off, a healthy battery should read 12.6 volts. If it's below 12.4, the battery is partially discharged or degraded. With the engine running, you should see around 14.4 volts. That's the alternator charging. If it's below 13.5, the alternator is weak. If it's above 15, the voltage regulator is overcharging and cooking the battery. This is a 30-second check that tells you whether your battery or alternator is about to strand you.
I want to say this clearly. A multimeter is not a specialist tool. You can buy one for 40 shekels at any hardware store. It has two probes and a dial. You don't need to understand electrical engineering to read a voltage. This is exactly the kind of thing we mean when we say the barrier to entry is psychological, not technical.
The check engine light. Let's talk about the check engine light because people treat it like a suggestion. It's not. On any gasoline car sold in Europe after 2001, which includes every seat Ibiza we're talking about, the car has OBD2 onboard diagnostics, and the check engine light has two modes. A solid light means there's an emissions-related fault. Schedule a service visit. A flashing light means stop driving right now. A flashing check engine light indicates a misfire that's dumping unburned fuel into the catalytic converter. That unburned fuel ignites inside the cat, and the cat's internal temperature skyrockets. The ceramic honeycomb inside melts, and now you've turned an $80 oxygen sensor problem into a $1,500 catalytic converter replacement.
The catalytic converter is expensive because it contains platinum group metals, platinum, palladium, rhodium, typically 3 to 7 grams total. That's the precious metal content driving the cost, not the complexity of the part. And on an older car, a P0420 code. Catalyst efficiency below threshold is often not the cat itself failing. It's a slow oxygen sensor, a small exhaust leak, or even a tired spark plug causing incomplete combustion. The underlying fix might be $100. But if you ignore the solid light, it eventually becomes the cat, and the cat is real money.
I've seen this exact scenario. A listener in Tel Aviv, same generation, Ibiza, had a solid check engine light for months, PO420 code. The upstream oxygen sensor was reading slow, so the engine was running slightly rich. The unburned fuel gradually clogged the catalytic converter. By the time they brought it in, the cat was completely blocked, the car had no power above about 60 kilometers an hour, and the repair was $1,500. Sorry, about 5,500 shekels, instead of the 400 shekels the oxygen sensor would have cost. The lesson. A solid check engine light isn't an emergency, but it's not permission to ignore it for 6 months either.
One more thing on the electrical side, the gearbox oil. This is one of those misconceptions we need to kill. People think manual transmissions never need maintenance. The gearbox oil, it's called gear oil, not engine oil, it's thicker. Degrades over time and accumulates metal particles from normal wear. Those metal particles are basically a grinding paste circulating through your gears and bearings. Change the gearbox oil every 60,000 kilometers, or 5 years. It's a simple drain and fill, maybe 2 liters of oil, costs about 300 shekels at an independent shop. Most manual transmission failures on older cars are from neglected oil, not worn synchros.
Tires are the only thing connecting your car to the road, and people evaluate them exclusively by tread depth. That's a mistake. Tire rubber hardens with age. It loses elasticity. A tire manufactured in 2018, and you can check this on the sidewall. There's a dot code. The last 4 digits are the week and year of manufacture. A tire from 2018 has rubber that's 8 years old now. That rubber has oxidized, it's lost volatile compounds, it's harder and less grippy than when it was new. On Jerusalem's polished cobblestone streets, or on wet winter roads coming down from the hills, that hardened rubber means longer braking distances and less cornering grip. Replace tires at 6 years regardless of tread depth.
The dot code is one of those things that once you know about it, you can't unsee it. It's a little oval on the sidewall with four numbers. 2122 means the 21st week of 2022. If you're looking at a used car and all four tires have dot codes from 2017, you know you're buying new tires immediately. That's a negotiating point on the purchase price, by the way.
If you're sitting there thinking, okay, what do I actually do on Monday morning? Here are three things.
First, create a maintenance calendar based on time, not just mileage. Set phone reminders. Brake fluid flush every 2 years. Coolant change every 3 years. Timing belt every 5 years or 96,000 kilometers, whichever comes first. Battery replacement every 4 years in a hot climate. Gearbox oil every 5 years or 60,000 kilometers. These are not aspirational targets. These are the intervals that prevent the failures we've been talking about.
Second, learn the inspection level checks that require no tools. The three-finger serpentine belt test. The multimeter battery check. Peeking at the timing belt for cracks and checking its day code. Reading your tire dot codes. Looking at your brake fluid reservoir. Fresh brake fluid is clear or light amber. Dark brown means it's full of water and needs changing. None of these require mechanical skill. They require attention.
Third, and this might be the most actionable thing we say today, find a good independent mechanic who specializes in Volkswagen Group cars. Seat is part of VW Group, shares platforms, engines, and parts with Volkswagen, Skoda, and Audi. An independent specialist knows these cars inside and out. Dealership labor rates in Jerusalem are around 400 shekels per hour. Independent shops are around 200 shekels per hour. That's half the labor cost on every single repair.
When you find that mechanic, here's a negotiation tactic that actually works. Ask to see the old parts. A good mechanic will show you what failed and explain why. If they're evasive about showing you the removed parts, find another mechanic. This isn't about distrust, it's about information. Seeing a corroded water pump or a cracked timing belt is how you understand why these maintenance intervals matter. It turns abstract advice into something you've held in your hand.
Also, when you go to that independent mechanic, be specific about what you want. Don't say, check the car. Say, please inspect the timing belt condition and date code and check the brake fluid water content. Mechanics are reactive by default. They fix what's broken. Proactive maintenance requires the owner to ask for specific checks. This is not being a difficult customer. This is being an informed owner.
The economics of all this are worth stating plainly. Proactive maintenance is cheaper than reactive repairs by a factor of 3 to 5 times. A brake fluid flush is 200 shekels. A brake system repair after contaminated fluid corrodes the calipers is 2,000 shekels. A timing belt job is 1,000 shekels. An engine replacement after a snapped belt is 10 to 15,000. A gearbox oil change is 300 shekels. A gearbox rebuild is 4 to 6,000. These are not close numbers. The math is not subtle.
There's a comparison that makes this concrete. Two identical 2010 Seat Ibizas, both at 100,000 kilometers. One had the clutch replaced proactively when the DMF started rattling. Smooth drivetrain, good fuel economy. The other is on the original clutch with a juddering flywheel. The first car gets about 8% better fuel economy just from reduced clutch slippage, which over 20,000 kilometers at Israeli fuel prices is about 600 shekels saved. The clutch job cost maybe 1,500 shekels. The second car will need a clutch soon anyway, and by the time it's replaced, the DMF damage might push the bill to 3,000 plus. The proactive owner spends less in total and had a better driving car the whole time.
Let's talk about one more Jerusalem-specific thing, dust. Jerusalem is dusty. The air is dry, there's construction everywhere, and fine dust gets into everything. Your engine air filter is the first line of defense, and in Jerusalem you should replace it twice as often as the manufacturer recommends. A clogged air filter reduces fuel economy and can cause the engine to run rich, which leads to carbon buildup and catalytic converter problems down the line. An air filter costs about 60 shekels and takes 30 seconds to swap. No tools required on most cars. Just unclip the airbox, lift out the old filter, drop in the new one.
The cabin air filter, while we're at it. That's the one that filters the air coming into the car through the ventilation system. In a dusty city, it clogs fast. When it's clogged, your air conditioning works harder, your windows fog up more easily, and the air inside the car is dirtier than the air outside. Also, a 60-shekel part, also a 1-minute swap, usually accessed from behind the glove box. People don't even know this filter exists half the time.
We've covered fluids, rubber, metal, electrical, tires, filters. The through line is that none of this is hard. It's not engine rebuilds. It's not welding. It's calendar reminders and looking at things and touching things and listening to things. The barrier is that car maintenance has been mystified. It's presented as this arcane domain that requires a lifetime of knowledge. And for the deep stuff, sure. But for the stuff that determines whether your car makes it to 200,000 kilometers, that's mostly calendar hygiene.
That's the core of it. But there's one bigger question that hangs over all of this. As cars become more computerized, is this DIY maintenance window closing? The EU mandated over-the-air diagnostic locks on new cars starting in 2025. That means the manufacturer can restrict who can access diagnostic data, who can clear fault codes, who can do certain repairs. If you buy a new car in 2028, you might not have the option to take it to an independent mechanic for anything beyond an oil change. The car will phone home, and the manufacturer will decide who's authorized to touch it.
Which makes cars like this. Seat Ibiza. Fully owner serviceable. No telematics. No remote lockdown. Not a burden, but an asset. A well-maintained older manual car is a hedge against depreciation and complexity. The Ibiza is a simple, robust platform. It's basically a Volkswagen Polo with Spanish styling. Parts are plentiful and cheap. The engines are well understood. Any competent mechanic can work on them. That's not a disadvantage. That's freedom.
Treat it like a tool, not a mystery. You don't need to understand the metallurgy of a hammer to use one. You just need to know not to leave it out in the rain. Your car is the same. Know the intervals. Do the checks. Find a good mechanic. And when something sounds different, feels different, or smells different, pay attention. The car is telling you something.
If you're the listener in Jerusalem with the Ibiza, you've got a good car. It's not fancy, but it's honest. Do the brake fluid. Check the timing belt history. Change the coolant. Learn the handbrake heel start. Find an independent VW specialist in Talpiot or Givat Shaul. You'll spend maybe 2,000 shekels a year on preventive maintenance and avoid a 15,000 shekel catastrophe. That's the whole game.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, Buzkashi players in Labrador reportedly insisted on competing only during fog so dense that the goat carcass was invisible from 10 feet away, claiming this proved divine favor when anyone actually scored.
A very specific kind of athletic spirituality.
I have so many questions about the goat carcass logistics in Labrador fog.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you have a weird prompt about keeping old tech alive, cars, computers, whatever, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We're at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Check your brake fluid.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.